You requested an audience with the crown, Cardin says. No, brother. It was you I wanted to speak with, not the ornament on your head.
Belkin's sly disrespect makes me wonder why he wanted this audience in the first place. I think of Matic, and how around him, I am perpetually a child. It's no small thing to pass judgment on the person who raised you, no matter what else they have done. This confrontation is less about this moment, and more about the vast sweep of their past, the warp and weft of old resentments and alliances between them.
What is it you want? Cardin asks.
His voice remains mild, but empty of the bored authority he usually wields.
What does any prisoner want?
Belkin says.
Let me out of the tower. If you mean to succeed, you need my help.
If you've been trying to see me only to say that, your efforts have been to no purpose. No, I will not release you. No, I do not need you.
Cardin sounds certain. Belkin smiles.
You've locked me away for fear of me. After all, you hated Eldred more than I did. You despise Dane. How can you punish me for deaths you do not regret?
Cardin looks at Belkin in disbelief, half rising from the throne. His fists are bald. His face is that of a person who has forgotten where he is.
What of Elowyn? What of Kalia and Rhaya? If all I cared for were my own feelings, their deaths would be enough reason for me to revenge myself on you. They were our sisters, and they would have been better rulers than either you or I.
I thought Belkin would back down at that, but he doesn't. Instead, an insidious little smile grows on his mouth.
Did they intercede for you? Did any one of your dear sisters take you in? How can you think they cared for you when they wouldn't go against father for your sake?
For a moment, I think Cardin is going to strike him. My hand goes to the hilt of my own sword. I will get in front of him. I will fight Belkin. It would be my pleasure to fight Belkin. Instead, Cardin slumps back down onto the throne. The fury leaves his face, and he speaks as though Belkin's last words went unheard.
But you are locked away, neither because I fear you, nor for revenge. I did not indulge myself with your punishment. You are in the tower because it is just.
You can't do this alone,
Belkin says, looking around the room.
You've never cared for work. Never cared to flatter diplomats or follow duty instead of pleasure. Give me the difficult tasks, instead of giving them to some mortal girl to whom you feel indebted and who will only fail you.
The eyes of Nior and Randolin and a few of the guards go to me, but Cardin watches his brother. After a long moment, he speaks.
You would be my regent, though I am of age. You come before me, not as a penitent, but as before a stray dog you would call to heel.
Finally, Belkin looks discomfited.
Although I have sometimes been harsh with you, it was because I sought to make you better. Do you think that you can be indolent and self-indulgent and yet succeed here as a ruler? Without me, you would be nothing. Without me, you will be nothing.
The idea that Belkin can say those words without believing them a lie is shocking. Cardin, for his part, wears a small smile, and when he speaks, his voice is light.
You threaten me. You praise yourself. You give away your desires, even were I considering your offer. After that little speech, I would be sure you were no diplomat.
Belkin takes a furious step toward the throne, and guards close the space between them. I can see Belkin's physical urge to punish Cardin.
You are playing at being king,
Belkin says.
And if you do not know it, Then you are the only one. Send me back to prison. Lose my help. And lose the kingdom.
That, Cardin says. The second option. The one that doesn't involve you. That's the one I choose.
He turns to Vulciber.
This audience is over.
As Vulciber and the other guards move to escort Baelkin back to the Tower of Forgetting, his gaze goes to me, and in his eyes, I see a well of hate so deep that I fear that if we're not careful, all of Elfheim may drown in it. 2 nights before my sister's wedding, I stand in front of the long mirror in my rooms and slowly draw Nightfell. I move through the stances, the ones Matic taught me, the ones I learned in the Court of Shadows. Then I raise my blade, presenting it to my opponent. I salute her in the mirror. Back and forth, I dance across the floor, fighting her. I strike and parry, parry and strike. I feign. I duck. I watch sweat bead on her forehead. I battle on until perspiration stains her shirt, until she's shaking with exhaustion. It's still not enough. I can never beat her.
Chapter 20. The trap for Orla is set. I spend the day with Matic going over the particulars. We created 3 specific times and places where the undersea could strike with some confidence. The boat itself, carrying a decoy, is obvious. It requires a hob to pretend to be oak, huddling in a cloak, and the boat itself to be enchanted to fly. Before that, there is a moment during Terran's reception when Oak is to wander off on his own into the maze. A section of the greenery will be replaced with tree folk, who will remain unseen until they need to strike. And even before that, upon arrival at Locke's estate for the wedding, Oak will seem to step out of the carriage onto an open patch of land visible from the ocean. We will employ the decoy there as well. I will wait with the real Oak in the carriage while the rest of the family goes out and, hopefully, the sea strikes. Then the carriage will pull around and we will climb straight through a window. In this case, the trees near the shore will be full of sprites, ready to spot the denizens of the undersea, and a net has been buried under the sand to trap them. 3 chances to catch the undersea in an attempt to harm Oak. 3 chances to make them regret trying. We do not neglect protecting Cardin either. His personal guard is on high alert. He has his own coterie of archers who will follow his every move. And, of course, our spies. Terran wants to spend her last night before the wedding with her sisters, so I pack up a dress and Terran's earrings in a rucksack and tie it to the back of the same horse I once took to Innsweil. I strap Nightfell across one saddlebag. Then I ride to Maddox's estate. The night is beautiful. A breeze runs through the trees, fragrant with the scent of pine needles and everapple. Distantly, I hear hoofbeats. Foxes make their odd screaming calls to one another. The trill of flute music comes from somewhere far off, along with the sound of mermaids singing their high-pitched, wordless songs out on the rocks. Then, abruptly, the hoofbeats are no longer distant. Through the woods come riders. 7 of them, mounted on the backs of pearl-eyed, emaciated horses. Their faces are covered, their armor splashed with white paint. I can hear their laughter as they split apart to come at me from different angles. For a moment, I think there must be some mistake. One of them draws an axe, which shines under the light of the first quarter moon, putting a chill into my blood. No. There is no mistake. They have come to kill me. My experience fighting on horseback is limited. I thought I would be a knight in Elfheim, defending some royal's body and honor, not riding into battles like Matic. Now, as they close in on me, I think about who was aware of that particular vulnerability. Certainly Matic knew. Perhaps this is his method of repaying me for my betrayal. Perhaps trusting me was a ruse. After all, he knew I was headed to his stronghold tonight,
and we spent the afternoon planning traps, just like this. Regretfully, I think of the roach's warning. Next time, take a member of the Royal Guard. Take one of us. Take a cloud of sprites, or a drunken spriggan. Just take someone. But it's just me. Alone. I urge my horse to greater speed. If I can make it through the woods and get close enough to the house, then I'll be safe. There are guards there, and whether or not Maddock put the riders up to this, he would never let a guest, not to mention his ward, be slain on his own lands. That wouldn't be playing by the rules of courtesy. All I have to do is make it. The hoofbeats pound behind me as we streak through the woods. I look back, wind in my face, hair blowing into my mouth. They're riding far apart, trying to get enough ahead of me to herd me away from Maddox, toward the coast, where there's nowhere to hide. Closer and closer they come. I can hear them calling to one another, but the words are lost in the wind. My horse is fast, but theirs flow like water through the night. As I look back, I see one of them has drawn a bow with black fletched arrows. I wheel my mount to one side, only to find another rider there cutting off my escape. They are armored, with weapons in hand. I have only a few knives on me, and Nightfell back with my saddlebags, along with a small crossbow and the pack itself. I walked through these woods hundreds of times in my childhood. I never thought I would need to be armored for battle here. An arrow whizzes past me as another rider closes, brandishing a blade. There is no way I will outrun them. I stand up in the stirrups, a trick I am not sure is going to work, and then grab hold of the next sturdy branch I pass. One of the white-eyed steeds bares its teeth and bites down on the flank of my own mount. My poor animal whinnies and bucks. In the moonlight, I think I make out amber eyes as a rider's long sword swings through the air. I vault up, hauling myself onto the branch. For a moment, I just hold on to it, breathing hard, as the riders pass beneath me. They wheel around. One takes a swig from a flask, leaving a golden stain on his lips.
"Little cat up in a tree," another calls. "Come down for the foxes."
I push myself to my feet, mindful of the ghost's lessons as I run along the branch. Three riders circle below me. There's a flash in the air as the axe flies in my direction. I duck, trying not to slip. The weapon whirls past me, biting into the trunk of the tree. "Nice try," I call, trying to sound anything but terrified. I've got to get away from them. I've got to get higher. But then what? I can't fight seven of them. Even if I wanted to try, my sword is still tied to my horse, and all I have are a few knives.
"Come down, human girl,"
says one with silvery eyes.
"We heard of your viciousness. We heard of your ferocity,"
says another, in a deep, melodious voice that might be female.
"Do not disappoint us."
A third notches another black-tipped arrow. "If I am to be a cat, let me give you a scratch," I say, pulling two leaf-shaped knives from my sides and sending them in two shining arcs toward the riders. One misses, and the other hits armor, but I hope it's enough of a distraction for me to tug the axe from the wood. Then I move. I jump from branch to branch as arrows fly all around, grateful for everything the ghost has ever taught me. Then an arrow takes me in the thigh. I am unable to bite back a cry of pain. I start moving again, pushing through the shock, but my speed is gone. The next arrow hits so near my side that it's only luck that saves me. They can see too well, even in the dark. They can see so much better than I can. The riders have all the advantages. Up in the trees, so long as I can't hide, all I am presenting is a slightly tricky target, but the fun kind of tricky. And the more tired I get, The more I bleed, the more I hurt, the slower I will become. And if I don't change the game, I am going to lose. I have to even the odds. I have to do something they won't expect. If I can't see, then I must trust my other senses. Sucking in a deep breath, ignoring the pain in my leg and the arrow still sticking out of it, axe in hand, I take a running jump off the branch with a howl. The riders try to turn their horses to get away from me. I catch a rider in the chest with the axe. The point of it folds his armor inward, which is quite a trick, or would have been if I didn't lose my balance a moment later. The weapon comes out of my hand as I fall. I hit the dirt hard, knocking the breath out of me. Immediately, I roll to avoid hoof strikes. My head is ringing, and my leg feels as though it's on fire when I push myself to my feet. I cracked the spine of the arrow sticking out of me, but I drove the point deeper. The rider I struck is hanging in his saddle, his body limp and his mouth bubbling red. Another rider wheels to the side while a third comes straight on. I draw a knife as the archer coming toward me attempts to switch back his sword. 6-1 is much better odds, especially when four of the riders are hanging back, as though they hadn't considered that they could get hurt too. "Ferocious enough for you?" I shout at them. The silver-eyed rider comes at me, and I throw my knife. It misses him, but hits the horse in the flank. The animal rears up, but as he tries to get his mount back under control, another barrels toward me. I grab for the axe, take a deep breath, and focus. The skeletal horse watches me with its pupil-less white eyes. It looks hungry. If I die here in the woods because I wasn't better prepared, because I was too distracted to bother to strap on my own stupid sword, I will be absolutely furious with myself. I brace as another rider bears down on me, but I am not sure I can withstand the charge. Frantically, I try to come up with another option. When the horse is close, I drop to the ground, fighting every instinct for survival, every urge to run from the huge animal. It rushes over me, and I lift the axe and chop upward. Blood spatters my face. The creature runs a little farther, and then drops with a vicious keening sound, trapping its rider's legs underneath its bulk. I push to my feet, wiping my face just in time to see the silver-eyed knight preparing to charge. I grin at him, lifting the bloody axe. The amber-eyed rider heads toward his fallen comrade, calling for the others. The silver-eyed knight wheels around at the sound, heading toward his companions. The trapped rider struggles as I watch the other two knights pulling him free and up onto one of the other horses. Then the six wheel away through the night, no more laughter following them. I wait, afraid they might double back, afraid that something worse is about to leap from the shadows. Minutes slip by. The loudest sound is my ragged breath and the roaring of blood in my ears. Shakily, painfully, I walk on through the woods, only to find my own steed lying in the grass, being devoured by the dead rider's horse. I wave my axe, and it runs away. Nothing makes my poor horse any less dead, though. My pack is gone from her back. It must have fallen during the ride, taking my clothing and crossbow with it. My knives are gone, too, littering the forest after I threw them, probably lost in the brush. At least Nightfell is still here, tied to the saddle. I unstrap my father's sword with cramping fingers. Using it as a cane, I manage to drag myself the rest of the way to Maddox's stronghold and wash off the blood in the pump outside. Inside, I find Oriana sitting near a window, sewing on an embroidery hoop. She looks at me with her pink eyes and does not bother to smile, as a human might, to put me at ease.
Taryn is upstairs with Vivi and her lover. Oak sleeps and Maddox schemes.
She takes in my appearance.
Did you fall in a lake? I nod. Stupid, right? She takes another stitch. I head for the stairs, and she speaks again before my foot can hit the first step.
Would it be so terrible for Oak to stay with me and Fairy? She asks.
There is a long pause, and then she whispers,
I do not wish to lose his love.
I hate that I have to say what she already knows. Here, there would be no end to courtiers pouring poison in his ear. Whispers of the king he would be if only Cardan was out of the way. And that, in turn, might make those loyal to Cardan desirous of getting Oak out of the way. And that's not even thinking about the biggest threats. So long as Baelkin lives, Oak's safest far from Fairy. Plus there's Orla. She nods, her expression bleak, and turns back to the window. Maybe she just needs someone else to be the villain. Someone to be responsible for keeping them apart. Good luck for her that I am someone she already doesn't much like. Still, I remember what it was like to miss where I grew up. Miss the people who raised me. You'll never lose his love, I say, my voice coming out as quietly as hers did. I know she can hear me, but still, she doesn't turn. With that, I go up the stairs, leg aching. I am at the landing when Maddock comes out of his office and looks up at me. He sniffs the air. I wonder if he smells the blood still running down my leg, if he smells the dirt and sweat and cold well water. A chill goes to my bones. I go into my old room and shut the door. I reach beneath my headboard, and I'm grateful to find that one of my knives is still there, sheathed and a little dusty. I leave it where it was, feeling a little safer. I limp over to my old tub, bite the inside of my cheek against the pain, and sit down on the edge. Then I slice my pants and inspect what remains of the arrow embedded in my leg. The cracked shaft is willow, stained with ash. What I can see of the arrowhead is made of jagged antler. My hands start to shake, and I realize how fast my heart is beating, how fuzzy my head feels. Arrow wounds are bad, because every time you move, the wound worsens. Your body can't heal with a sharp bit cutting up tissue, and the longer it's there, the harder it is to get out. Taking a deep breath, I slide my fingers down to the arrowhead and press on it lightly. It hurts enough that I gasp and go lightheaded for a moment, but it doesn't seem lodged in bone. I brace myself, take the knife, and cut about an inch down the skin of my leg. It's excruciating, and I am breathing in shallow huffs by the time I work my fingers into the skin and pull the arrowhead free. There's a lot of blood, a scary amount. I press my hand against it, trying to stop the flow. For a while, I am too dizzy to do anything but sit there.
Jude?
It's Vivi, opening the door. She takes a look at me, and then at the tub. Her cat eyes widen. I shake my head. Don't tell anyone. You're bleeding, she says. Get me. I start, and then stop, realizing that I need to stitch up the wound, that I didn't think of that. Maybe I am not as okay as I thought I was. Shock doesn't always hit right away. I need a needle and thread, not thin stuff, embroidery floss, and a cloth to keep putting pressure on the wound. She frowns at the knife in my hand, the freshness of the wound. Did you do that to yourself? That snaps me out of my daze for a moment. Yes, I shot myself with an arrow. Okay, okay. She hands me a shirt from the bed and then goes out of the room. I press the fabric against the wound, hoping to slow the bleeding. When she gets back, she's holding white thread and a needle. That thread is not going to be white for long. Okay, I say, trying to concentrate. You want to hold or sew? Hold, she says, looking at me as though she wished there was a third option.
Don't you think I should get Taryn? The night before her wedding? Absolutely not. I try to thread the needle, but my hands are shaking badly enough that it's difficult. Okay. Now push the sides of the wound together. Vivi kneels down and does, making a face. I gasp and try not to pass out. Just a few more minutes, and I can sit down and relax, I promise myself. Just a few more minutes, and it will be like this never happened. I stitch. It hurts. It hurts and hurts and hurts. After I'm done, I wash the leg with more water and rip off the cleanest section of the shirt to wrap around it. She comes closer.
Can you stand?
In a minute. I shake my head.
What about Maddock?
She asks.
We could tell
no one, I say, and gripping the edge of the tub, kick my leg over, biting back a scream. Vivi turns on the taps, and water splashes out, washing away the blood.
Your clothes are soaked, she says, frowning.
Hand me a dress from over there, I say. Look for something sack-like. I force myself to limp over to a chair and sink into it. Then I pull off my jacket and the shirt underneath it, naked to my waist. I can't go any further without pain stopping me. Vivi brings over a dress, one so old that Taryn didn't bother to take it to me, and bunches it up so she can lift it over my head, then guides my hands through the armholes, as though I were a child. Gently, she takes off my boots and the remains of my pants.
You could lie down, she says. Rest.
Heather and I can distract Taryn. I am going to be fine, I say.
You don't have to do anything else, is all I'm saying.
Vivi looks as though she's reconsidering my warnings about coming here.
Who did this?
7 riders. Maybe knights.
But who was actually behind the attack? I don't know.
Vivi gives a long sigh.
Jude, come back to the human world with me. This doesn't have to be normal. This isn't normal.
I get up out of the chair. I would rather walk on the wounded leg than listen to more of this.
What would have happened if I hadn't come in here? She demands.
Now that I am up, I have to keep moving or lose momentum. I head for the door. I don't know, I say, but I do know this. Danger can find me in the mortal world, too.
My being here lets me make sure you and Oak have guards watching you there.
Look, I get that you think what I am doing is stupid, but don't act like it's useless.
That's not what I meant, she says,
but by then I am in the hall. I jerk open the door to Taryn's room to find her and Heather laughing at something. They stop when we come in.
Jude?
Taryn asks. I fell off my horse, I tell her. And Vivi doesn't contradict me.
What are we talking about?
Taryn is nervous, roaming around the room to touch the gauzy gown she will wear tomorrow, to hold up the circlet, woven with greenery grown in goblin gardens, and fresh as the moment they were plucked. I realize that the earrings I bought for Taryn are gone, lost with the rest of the pack, scattered among leaves and underbrush. Servants bring wine and cakes, and I lick the sweet icing and let the conversation wash over me. The pain in my leg is distracting, but more distracting yet is the memory of the riders laughing, the memory of their closing in beneath the tree,
the memory of being wounded and frightened, and all alone.
When I wake the day of Taryn's wedding, it is in the bed of my childhood. It feels like coming up from a deep dream, and for a moment, it's not that I don't know where I am, it's that I don't remember who I am. For those few moments, blinking in the late morning sunlight, I am Maddock's loyal daughter, dreaming of becoming a knight in the court. Then the last half year comes back to me like the now familiar taste of poison in my mouth.
like the sting of the sloppily done stitches. I push myself up and unwrap the cloth to look at the wound. It's ugly and swollen, and the needlework is poor. My leg is stiff, too. Narbonne, an enormous servant with long ears and a tail, comes into my room with a belated knock. He is carrying a tray with breakfast on it. Quickly, I flip the blankets over my lower body. He puts the tray on the bed without comment and goes into the bath area. I hear the rush of water and smell crushed herbs. I sit there, braced, until he leaves. I could tell him I'm hurt. It would be a simple thing. If I asked Narbonne to send for a military surgeon, he'd do it. He'd tell Oriana and Matic, of course. But my leg would be stitched up well, and I'd be safe from infection. Even if Matic had sent the riders, I believe he'd still take care of me. Courtesy, after all. He'd take it to be a concession, though. I'd be admitting that I needed him. That he won. That I'd come home for good. And yet, in the light of the morning, I am fairly sure it wasn't Matic who sent the riders. Even if it was the sort of trap he favors. He would have never sent assassins who hung back and who rode off when the numbers were still on their side. Once Narbonne goes out, I drink the coffee greedily and make my way to the bath. It's milky and fragrant, and only under the water can I allow myself to weep. Only under the water can I admit that I almost died, and that I was terrified, and that I wish there was someone to whom I could tell all that. I hold my breath until there's no more breath to hold. After the bath, I wrap myself in an old robe and make it to the bed. As I try to decide if it's worth sending a servant back to the palace to get me another dress, or if I should just borrow something of Terran's, Oriana comes into the room, holding a silvery piece of cloth.
"The servants tell me you brought no luggage," she says. "I assume you forgot that your sister's wedding would require a new gown, or a gown at all."
"At least one person is going to be naked," I say. "You know it's true. I've never been to a single revel in Faerie where everyone had clothes on."
"Well, if that's your plan," she says, turning on her heels, "then I suppose all you need is a pretty necklace."
"Wait," I say. "You're right. I don't have a dress, and I need one. Please don't go." When Oriana turns, a hint of a smile is on her face.
"How unlike you, to say what you actually mean, and have it be something other than hostile."
I wonder how it is for her to live in Maddox's house, to be Maddox's obedient wife, and have had a hand in all of his schemes being undone. Oriana is capable of more subtlety than I would have given her credit for. And she has brought me a dress. That seems like a kindness, until she spreads it out on my bed.
"It's one of mine," she says. "I believe it will fit."
The gown is silver, and reminds me a little of chainmail. It's beautiful, with trumpet sleeves slashed along the length of the arm to show skin. But it has a plunging neckline, which would look one way on Oriana, and a totally different way on me. It's a little, daring for a wedding, don't you think? There's no way to wear it with a bra. She just looks at me for a moment, with a puzzled, almost insect-like stare. "I guess I can try it on," I say, remembering that I had joked about being naked just a moment ago. This being Faerie, she makes no move to leave. I turn around, hoping that will be enough to draw attention away from my leg, as I strip. Then I pull the gown over my head and let it slither over my hips. It sparkles gorgeously, but as I suspected, it shows a lot of my chest. Like, a lot. Oriana nods, satisfied.
"I will send someone to do your hair."
A short while later, a willowy pixie girl has braided my hair into ram's horns and wrapped the tips with silver ribbon.
She paints the lids of my eyes and my mouth with more silver. Then, dressed, I go downstairs to join the rest of the family in Oriana's parlor, as though the last few months haven't happened. Oriana is dressed in a gown of pale violet, with a collar of fresh petals that rises to her powdery jawline. Vivi and Heather are both in mortal clothes. Vivi in a fluttery fabric with a pattern of eyes printed on the cloth, and Heather in a short pink dress with little silver spangles all over it. Heather's hair is pulled back in sparkling pink clips. Maddock is wearing a deep plum tunic, Oak in a matching tone.
"Hey," Heather says. "We're both in silver."
Taryn isn't there yet. We sit around the parlor, drinking tea and eating bannocks.
"Do you really think she's going to go through with this?"
Vivi asks. Heather gives her a scandalized look, swats at her leg. Maddock sighs.
"It is said we learn more from our failures than our successes,"
he says, with a pointed look in my direction. Then Taryn finally comes down. She's been bathed in lilac dew and wears a gown of incredibly fine layers of cloth on top of one another, herbs and flowers trapped between them to give the impression that she's this beautiful floating figure and a living bouquet at the same time. Her hair is braided into a crown with green blooms all through it. She looks beautiful and painfully human. In all that pale fabric, she looks like a sacrifice instead of a bride. She smiles at all of us, shy and glowingly happy. We all rise and tell her how beautiful she looks. Maddock takes her hands and kisses them, looking at her like any proud father, even though he thinks she's making a mistake. We get into the carriage, along with the small Hob, who is going to be Oak's double, who switches jackets once we're inside, and then sits worriedly in a corner. On our way to Locke's estate, Taryn leans forward and catches my hand. "Once I am married, things will be different." "Some things," I say, not entirely sure what she's talking about. "Dad has promised to keep him in line," she whispers. I recall Taryn's appeal to me to have Locke dismissed from his position as Master of Revels. Curbing Locke's indulgences is likely to keep Maddock busy, which seems like no bad thing.
"Are you happy for me?" she asks. "Truly?"
Taryn has been closer to me than any other person in the world. She has known the tide and undertow of my feelings, my hurts, both small and large, for most of my life. It would be stupid to let anything interfere with that. "I want you to be happy," I say. "Today and always." She gives me a nervous smile, and her fingers tighten on mine. I am still holding her hand when the hedge maze comes into view. I see three pixie girls in diaphanous gowns fly over the greenery, giggling together, and beyond them, other folk already beginning to mill. As Master of Revels, Locke has organized a wedding worthy of the title.
Chapter 21. The first trap goes unsprung. The decoy climbs out with my family, while Oak and I duck down in the carriage. He grins at me at first, when we huddle down in the space between the cushioned benches, but the grin slips off his face a moment later, replaced by worry. I take his hand and squeeze it. "Ready to climb through a window?" That delights him anew.
"From the carriage?"
"Yes," I say, and wait for it to pull around. When it does, there's a knock. I peek out and see the bomb inside the estate. She winks at me, and then I lift Oak and feed him, hooves first, through the carriage window and into her arms. I climb after, inelegantly. My dress is ridiculously revealing, and my leg is still stiff, still hurting, when I fall onto Locke's stone floor. "Anything?" I ask, looking up at the bomb. She shakes her head, extending a hand to me, That was always the long shot. My bet is on the maze.
Oak frowns, and I rub his shoulders. You don't have to do this, I tell him, although I'm not sure what we'll do if he says he won't.
I'm okay, he says, without looking into my eyes. Where's my mom?
I'll find her for you, Twiggling, says the bomb, and puts her arm over his thin shoulder to lead him out. At the doorway, she looks back at me and fishes something out of her pocket.
You seem to have hurt yourself. Good thing I don't just cook up explosives.
With that, she tosses me something. I catch it without knowing what it is, and then turn it over in my hand. A pot of ointment. I look back up to thank her, but she's already gone. Unstoppering the little pot, I breathe in the scent of strong herbs. Still, once I spread it over my skin, my pain diminishes. The ointment cools the heat of what was probably imminent infection. The leg is still sore, but nothing as it was.
My seneschal, Cardin says, and I nearly drop the ointment. I tug down my dress, turning.
Are you ready to welcome Locke into your family?
The last time we were in this house, in the maze of the gardens, his mouth was streaked with golden nevermore, and he watched me kiss Locke with a simmering intensity that I thought was hatred. Now he studies me with a not dissimilar look, and all I want to do is walk into his arms. I want to drown my worries in his embrace. I want him to say something totally unlike himself, about things being okay.
Nice dress,
he says instead. I know the court must already think I am besotted with the High King, to endure being crowned Queen of Mirth and still serve as his seneschal. Everyone must think, as Matic does, that I am his creature. Even after he humiliated me, I came crawling back. But what if I actually am becoming besotted with him? Cardin is more knowledgeable than I am at love. He could use that against me, just as I asked him to use it against Nicasia. Perhaps he found a way to turn the tables after all. Kill him, a part of me says. A part I remember from the night I took him captive. Kill him before he makes you love him. You shouldn't be alone, I say, because if the Undersea is going to strike, then we must not give it any easy targets. Not tonight. Cardin grins.
I hadn't planned on it.
The offhand implication that he's not alone most nights bothers me, and I hate that it does. Good, I say, swallowing that feeling, though it feels like swallowing bile. But if you're planning on taking someone to bed, or better yet, several someones, choose guards, and then have yourselves guarded by more guards.
A veritable orgy.
He seems delighted by the idea. I keep thinking of the steady way he looked at me when we were both naked, before he pulled on his shirt and fastened those elegant cuffs.
We should have called truce,
he'd said, brushing back his ink-black hair impatiently.
We should have called truce long before this.
But neither of us called it. Not then. Not after. Jude, he'd said, running a hand up my calf. Are you afraid of me? I clear my throat, forcing the memories away. I command you not to allow yourself to be alone from tonight's sundown to tomorrow's sunup. He draws back, as though bitten. He no longer expects me to deliver orders in this high-handed way, as though I don't trust him. The High King of Elfheim makes a shallow bow.
Your wish? No. Strike that. Your command is my command,
he says. I cannot look at him as he goes out. I am a coward. Maybe it's the pain in my leg. Maybe it's worry over my brother. But a part of me wants to call after him. Wants to apologize. Finally, when I am sure he's gone, I head toward the party. A few steps, and I am in the hallway. Matic leans against the wall. His arms are crossed over his chest, and he shakes his head at me.
It never made sense to me. Until now.
I stop,
What?
I was coming in to get Oak when I heard you speaking with the High King. Forgive me for eavesdropping.
I can barely think through the thundering in my ears. It's not what you think.
If it wasn't, you wouldn't know what I thought.
Maddox counters.
Very clever, daughter. No wonder you weren't tempted by anything I offered you. I said I wouldn't underestimate you. And yet I did. I underestimated you. And I underestimated both your ambition and your arrogance.
No, I say. You don't understand.
Oh, I think I do,
he says, not waiting for me to explain about Oak's not being ready for the throne, about my desire to avoid bloodshed, about how I don't even know if I can hang on to what I have for longer than a year and a day. He's too angry for any of that.
At last, I finally understand. Orla and the Undersea we will vanquish together. But when they are gone, it will be us staring across a chessboard at each other. And when I best you, I will make sure I do it as thoroughly as I would any opponent who has shown themselves to be my equal.
Before I can think of what to say to that, he grabs hold of my arm, marching us together onto the green.
Come,
he says.
We have roles yet to play.
Outside, blinking in the late afternoon sun, Maddox leaves me to go speak with a few knights standing in a tight knot near an ornamental pool. He gives me a nod when he departs, the nod of someone acknowledging an opponent. A shiver goes through me. When I confronted him in Hollow Hall after poisoning his cup, I thought I had made us enemies. But this is far worse. He knows I stand between him and the crown. And it matters little whether he loves or hates me. He will do whatever it takes to wrest that power from my hands. With no other options, I head into the maze, toward the celebration at its center. Three turns, and it seems that the partygoers are farther away. Sounds grow muffled, and faint laughter comes from every direction. The boxwoods are high enough to be disorienting. Seven turns, and I am truly lost. I start back, only to find the maze has changed itself around. The paths are not where they were before. Of course, it can't just be a normal maze. No, it's got to be out to get me. I remember that among this foliage are the tree folk, waiting to keep Oak safe. Whether they're the ones messing with me now, I do not know. But at least I can be sure something is listening when I speak.
I will slice my way clean through you, I say to the leafy walls. Let's start playing fair.
Branches rustle behind me. When I turn, there's a new path. This better be the way to the party, I grumble, starting on it. I hope this doesn't lead to the secret oubliette reserved for people who threaten the maze. Another turn, and I come to a stretch of little white flowers and a stone tower built in miniature. From inside, I hear a strange sound, half growl and half cry. I draw Nightfell. Not many things weep in Faerie, and the weeping things that are more common here, like banshees, are very dangerous.
Who is in there? I say. Come out, or I am coming in.
I'm surprised to see Heather shuffle into view. Her ears have grown furred and long, like that of a cat. Her nose is differently shaped, and the stubs of whiskers are growing above her eyebrows and from the apples of her cheeks. Worse, since I can't see through it, it's not a glamour. It's a real spell of some kind, and I don't think it's done with her. As I watch, a light dusting of fur grows along her arms in a patterning not unlike a tortoiseshell cat.
What happened? I stammer.
She opens her mouth, but instead of an answer, a piteous yowling comes out. Despite myself, I laugh, not because it's funny, but because I'm startled. Then I feel awful,
especially when she hisses. I squat down, wincing at the pulling of my stitches. Don't panic. I'm sorry. You just took me by surprise. This is why I warned you to keep that charm on you.
She makes another hissing yowl.
Yeah, I say, sighing. No one likes to hear, "I told you so." Don't worry. Whatever jerk thought this was going to be a fun prank is about to have a lot of regrets. Come on. She follows me, shivering. When I try to put an arm around her, she flinches away with another hiss. At least she remains upright. At least she is human enough to stay with me and not run off. We plunge into the hedges, and this time the maze doesn't mess with us. In three turns, we are standing among guests. A fountain splashes gently, the sound of it mixing with conversation. I look around, searching for someone I know. Taryn and Locke aren't there. Most likely, they have gone to a bower, where they will make private vows to each other, their true fairy marriage, unwitnessed and mysterious. In a land where there are no lies, promises need not be public to be binding. Vivi rushes over to me, taking Heather's hands. Her fingers have curled under in a paw-like manner.
"What's happened?" Oriana demands.
"Heather?"
Oak wants to know. She looks at him with eyes that match my sister's. I wonder if that was the heart of the jest. A cat for a cat-eyed girl.
"Do something," Vivi says to Oriana.
"I am no deft hand at enchantments," she says.
"Undoing curses was never my specialty."
"Who did this? They can undo it." My voice has a growl to it that makes me sound like Matic. Vivi looks up with a strange expression on her face.
"Jude," Oriana cautions,
but Heather points with her knuckles. Standing by a trio of flute-playing fawns is a boy with cat ears. I stride across the maze toward him. One hand goes to the hilt of my sword. All the frustration I feel over everything I cannot control bends toward fixing this one thing. My other hand knocks the goblet of green wine out of his grip. The liquid pools on the clover before sinking into the earth under our feet.
"What is this?"
he demands.
"You put a curse on that girl over there," I tell him.
"Fix her immediately."
"She admired my ears,"
the boy says.
"I was only giving her what she desired. A party favor."
"That's what I'm going to say after I gut you and use your entrails as streamers," I tell him. "I was only giving him what he wanted. After all, if he didn't want to be eviscerated, he would have honored my very reasonable request." With furious looks at everyone, he stomps across the grass and speaks a few words. The enchantment begins to dissipate. Heather weeps anew, though, as her humanity returns. Huge sobbing gasps shake her.
"I want to go,"
she says finally, in a quavering, wet voice.
"I want to go home, right now, and never come back."
Vivi should have prepared her better. Should have made sure she always wore a charm. Or better yet, two. She should never have let Heather wander off alone. I fear that, in some measure, this is my fault. Taryn and I hid from Vivi the worst of what it was to be human in Faerie. I think Vivi believed that because her sisters were fine, Heather would be too. But we were never fine.
"It's going to be okay,"
Vivi is saying, rubbing Heather's back in soothing circles.
"You're okay. Just a little weirdness. Later, you're going to think it was funny."
"She's not going to think it was funny," I say, and Vivi flashes me an angry look. The sobbing continues. Finally, Vivi puts her finger under Heather's chin, raising her face to look fully into it.
"You're okay,"
Vivi says again, and I can hear the glamour in her voice. The magic makes Heather's whole body relax.
"You don't remember the last half hour.
You've been having a lovely time at the wedding, but then took a spill. You were crying because you bruised your knee. Isn't that silly?
Heather looks around, embarrassed, and then wipes her eyes.
I feel a little ridiculous, she says with a laugh. I guess I was just surprised.
Vivi, I hiss.
I know what you're going to say,
Vivi tells me under her breath. But it's just this one time. And before you ask, I've never done it before.
But she doesn't need to remember all of that.
Of course she does, I say. Or she won't be careful next time. I am so angry that I can barely speak. But I need to make Vivi understand. I need to make her realize that even terrible memories are better than weird gaps or the hollowness of your feelings not making sense. But before I can begin, the ghost is at my shoulder, Volsibur beside him. They are both in uniform.
Come with us, the ghost says, uncharacteristically blunt.
What is it? I ask them, my voice sharp. I am still thinking about Vivi and Heather. The ghost is as grim as I've ever seen him.
The undersea made its move.
I look around for Oak, but he is where I left him moments before, with Oriana, watching Heather insist that she's fine. A small frown creases the space between his brows, but he seems otherwise utterly safe from everything but bad influence. Cardan stands on the other side of the green, near where Taryn and Locke have just come back from swearing their vows. Taryn looks shy, with roses in her cheeks. Folk rush over to kiss her. Goblins and Griggs, court ladies and hags. The sky is bright overhead, the wind sweet and full of flowers.
The Tower of Forgetting. Volsibur insists you ought to see it, the bomb says.
I didn't even notice her walking up. She's all in black, her hair pulled into a tight bun.
Jude?
I turn back to my spies. I don't understand.
We will explain on the way,
Volsibur says.
Are you ready?
Just a second. I should congratulate Taryn before I leave. Kiss her cheeks and say something nice. And then she will know I was here, even if I had to go. But as I look toward her, evaluating how swiftly I can do that, my gaze catches on her earrings. Dangling from her lobes are a moon and a star, the same ones I bargained for from Grimson, the ones I lost in the wood. She wasn't wearing them when we got in the carriage, so she must have got them. Beside her, Locke is smiling his fox smile, and when he walks, he has a slight limp. For a moment, I just stare, my mind refusing to acknowledge what I am seeing. Locke. It was Locke with the riders. Locke and his friends on the night before he was to be married. A bachelor party of sorts. I guess he decided to pay me back for threatening him. That, or perhaps he knew he could never stay faithful and decided to go after me before I came back for him. I take one last look at them and realize I can do nothing now. Pass the news about the undersea on to the Grand General, I tell the bomb. And make sure.
I'll watch over your brother, she reassures me. And the High King.
Turning my back on the wedding, I follow Volsibur and the ghost. Yellow horses with long manes are nearby, already saddled and bridled. We swing up onto them and ride to the prison. From the outside, the only evidence that something might be wrong is the waves striking higher than I've ever seen them. Water has pooled on the uneven flagstones. Inside, I see the bodies. Knights, lying pale and still. The few on their backs have water filling their mouths, as though their lips were the edges of cups. Others lie on their sides. All their eyes have been replaced with pearls. Drowned on dry land. I rush down the stairs, terrified for Cardin's mother. She is there, though, alive. Blinking out at me from the gloom. For a moment, I just stand in front of her cell, hand on my chest in relief. Then I draw Nightfell and cut straight down between Bar and Locke.
Sparks fly, and the door opens. Asha looks at me suspiciously.